that just one more time?
It was like a family on the show, you know? It was like a family on the show.
That 7 years changed my life.
That's very emotional, you know?
Guess what? This is Deep Space Nine. Don't get too comfortable.
Transfer complete.
Hello, and welcome to Subspace Transmissions, the podcast where two Trek fans step into the arena and tackle the best, worst, weirdest, wildest, and everything in between that Star Trek has to offer. I'm Cam Smith, and joining me on the DS9 bridge...
You mean Ops?
Yes.
It's Tyler Orton, basking in Gene Roddenberry being my Curzon Dax.
Oh my.
Yeah.
And we're here this week to talk about... What We Left Behind. We'll do a spoiler review and delve into their season 8 that they pitch in this new documentary.
Yeah, so Ken, we did the non-spoiler review, and I actually thought it was quite an interesting show for us in that we were able to touch on this more from the thematic level and
right.
touch on Deep Space Nine's legacy. It's not going to be a repetitive one, I would say. We get to actually delve into the nitty-gritty and then talk about one of the big things that I think everyone's very curious about is... Whatever happened to the people that we're so familiar with 20 years later with this hypothetical season 8 that was like kind of animated in a very cool way that
yeah.
I just really appreciated it. Do you want to jump off on like generally kind of spoiler thoughts first and then
or do
you
want to talk about the theater experience? Because
yeah.
to me, that was such an exciting part of seeing it. We saw it last night, you know, in terms of when we were recording, and it was really cool.
So can we went in, we really weren't sure how many we should expect in downtown Vancouver to come out and see this documentary.
Well, we had a bit of a running joke because they did a revival a while back where they showed a bunch of the classic Star Trek movies, and you and I went and saw Star Trek the Motion Picture, and you took a photo of me sitting alone in an empty theater, you know, doing the Vulcan salute, and that photo became a running joke with our friends and I.
Yeah.
And when we were talking about this documentary, we would say, like, how many people do you think are going to be in the room? And that photo would get sent back and forth. And, like, I don't think we really thought this would be a draw in Vancouver.
Yeah, it just because Vancouver isn't necessarily... I don't know. We've been to other movies with regards to Star Trek.
The motion
and
picture.
We haven't seen a ton of people come out. So I think that's kind of what you're getting at
yeah,
here.
Yeah,
so,
sure.
like, how much would this draw into it? I walked in. I was, you know, I think maybe fourth, fifth, sixth person in there.
Mm-hmm.
Within moments, the theater was just filling up. And by the time you came in, there's, what, about 40, 50 people in there. By the time the screens got going, there's 60 people in this small auditorium.
Yeah.
It was more filled than it wasn't filled. And I was just blown away by how many people are so passionate about this. And I wonder, you know, I posed this kind of thoughts in one of our WhatsApp groups, but I mean, do you think it was kind of that Indiegogo platform really worked wonders when it came to marketing, getting the word out versus what other, you know, movie screenings may not be able to do?
It also seemed like maybe because of that, it got a lot more press than you would ever think a Star Trek documentary would get.
Sure. Oh,
yeah. Like mainstream press was posting links to the trailers and stuff like that. And like they weren't really doing that for the love of Spock. You know, it definitely felt like I think it must have grabbed maybe some of the mainstream press because it's like, wait, how much did this thing cost and how much did it make in such a small amount of time? Like, I think that was a bit of a shocker for, you know, a press industry that doesn't really think of Deep Space Nine perhaps that much.
Yeah, but beyond just the bodies in the theater, though, I think the thing that jumped out to us is just how engaged this audience was.
Yeah.
And the thing that we walked away with when we did our spoiler-free review is that this is most certainly a documentary made for the fans.
Yeah.
And it's nice for us to get some confirmation on that by being in there with fans who they were laughing at all the stuff you were meant to laugh at. They were gasping at a lot of things you were meant to gasp at.
Yeah.
And it was just kind of an amazing sort of communal experience that we got to have with all these people that we knew they would not be there had they had no love or passion for a series such as DS9.
Yeah, the woman who was actually sitting next to me was very responsive throughout the documentary. Not in a, like any sort of annoying way, but in a way where I could really feel that she was really enjoying it. I was genuinely moved by it at several points. And I thought it was interesting. She was a woman of color. And when they're delving into a lot of stuff to do with Cisco and the family, like, she was very responsive. And you could just get the sense, like, this meant a lot to her. Mm-hmm. And she was crying by the time the documentary ended.
Wow.
And so, like, that was really powerful because, you know, I can be a cold-hearted person, so I'm kind of sitting there with my arms crossed, like, impress me movie.
Yeah.
But, like, it was really cool to see it with someone who obviously was so touched by it on a personal level.
You had one of those individuals on each side of you that night, Cam.
You'd run out crying long ago.
Yeah. But the other thing is you bring up the somebody who was responding to it in real time. There were more than a few fellas that whenever, like, say, Mark Alima would come on screen, they'd be like, hey, there's Dongle Ducat. Whoa. And it's just like, and they're like, oh, it's Rome. And it's just like, there are a lot of people that were, like, narrating what was going on screen.
It's just insane to sit in a theater, a crowded, almost sold out theater, and see Max Grodinchik singing DS9 songs. Like, that is insane.
Well, that's just, you and I, we go to the big Star Trek Las Vegas convention.
Yeah.
We're used to seeing Max Grodinchik serenade the crowd in kind of this sort of, you know, lounge singer style.
Yeah.
I don't know what the rest of the audience was thinking when, like, this came on screen as the introduction to the entire documentary. Like, they must have been going, like, huh, okay.
Yeah.
You know, like there's some funny lyrics, and we get, like, kind of a menage of... I was going to say
a menage of
Troy.
Yeah.
Now we get a montage of all these various characters from the series. So, you know, you're in the right room.
Right.
You know, it's not that big of a deal, but it was kind of surreal. And then they immediately break into space battles. And then all of a sudden, Andy Robinson comes on screen and he's like, space battles? You got to be kidding me. And the first time you and I watched this, like, on streaming, I was like, what kind of documentary am I in for? Like, this is not like any doc I've ever seen before. And that's kind of when I realized, oh, they are making this for the fans. They want us to be entertained right out of the gate here.
I love Andy Robinson in that intro. Like, he is unhinged, but in a glorious way. Like, as an actor, he's really good at playing those types of roles. He's the villain in the original Dirty Harry, and he's really memorable. Yeah, Scorpio. He's super memorable in that. But, like, when Andy Robinson comes in and starts giving this monologue, I'm just like, this is absolutely bizarre. But it's in all the greatest ways. You know, I was so on board with it.
Yeah.
And you can just tell the audience is totally on board with him. Like, Garrick's reputation has grown so much over the years.
Oh, and they even address that directly in the documentary. And I think what we can also take away from this is that they go through character by character and talk about kind of the character's legacy, what made them grow, how the actors felt about it. Ira Stephen Bear says, you know, up front, originally, he wanted to make this for the actors on the show. And then he just included so many more people. And I think this is such a love letter both to the fans, but to the actors as well. And that's very clear. I want to ask you this, though. Who do you think was best served amongst the actors for...
I was going to raise that, yeah.
And then who was maybe not as well showcased?
I think the two that I would say were not showcased particularly well even are Bashir. I think Bashir gets very short shrift, especially when you look at, like, the bumpy journey that character went on in terms of the writing, and obviously all the stuff that came in later when we found out he was genetically enhanced. Like, I think that's really key to why that character is so interesting by the end.
But I don't know if Sadiq El-Fadel ever really liked that aspect of it, and I wonder if that's why...
Why wouldn't they address that? Like, just the sense of, like...
Well, this is a warts and all documentary.
Yeah, exactly. So I would have liked to know, like, why was this character perhaps bumpy versus a different one? Like, they don't actually say any of the characters were, you know, they struggled with throughout the show. Yeah. And I don't think there's anything wrong with, and I don't think Ira Stephen Bear would hold back either, in saying, like, we struggled with this character for a while, but we really nailed him down with this story or whatever.
Sadiq El-Fadel does bring up how early on in the series, like Bashir was supposed to be the sex symbol, but he just seemed like kind of a dope that couldn't...
Well, they kept writing him these really goofy scenes where he won't stop talking.
Yeah, but it was hilarious to watch. People were laughing at, like, how much his character changed. And that's just it. the Bashir that started at the series was very different from the Bashir that ended the series, and it was a very organic sort of arc for me, and I really like that. One character that maybe wasn't super showcased that much was O'Brien.
That was the other one I was going to say.
And I wonder if that's because he's kind of a tough one in that he's the everyman fan favorite. You like that character, but he's more of a static character, and I think it's because he's a little bit less damaged than the other people. He's more of that family man. He has to have that kind of solid base to him in order to be kind of this family guy. And so that's why I wonder if his character arc was less pronounced, even though he had some amazing Torture O'Brien episodes, of course, across the series.
But when you look at the impact of DS9, and, you know, you look at, like, Sisko as, like, your first black captain, you have Akira, this really complex character with, you know, these terrorist roots. You have Dax, a character who feels in many ways ahead of her time for television at that point. What do you say about O'Brien that kind of feeds into the overall thesis of the documentary about the impact of this show?
Well, you bring that up, and I wonder if there is a bit of an out here in that there were things cut out, and it seems as if...
The stuff with the friendship between Bashir and O'Brien.
Yeah, and I wonder if maybe that's going to be something left for the special features, because at the very end, and again, just to show you what a wacky sort of amazing documentary this was, you have both Nana Visitor and Iris Steven Bear coming over the credits and saying, yeah, you know, I wanted to include Iggy Pop.
Yeah.
And Nana Visitor's like, Iggy Pop? Come on, there's so many other things that you could have included. And they discussed how they wanted to delve into In the Pale Moonlight, Trials and Tribulations, as well as the Bashir and O'Brien friendship.
Visitor as well.
Yeah. So there's, I think Nana Visitor just brought that up, you know, just because of that. As she called that episode the amazingly named The Visitor.
I do think that episode's lack of representation in the documentary is a little troubling.
I'm not saying
they got to dedicate minutes to it. I just mean, I feel like it should have been mentioned.
Yeah, and at least they mentioned at the end. And I do suspect there's just going to be all these special feature things that we can delve into. But it is the one thing that popped up to me, though, they did showcase a couple episodes, one of which is Past Tense, which it's one that you and I appreciate.
Yeah.
But I don't know if that's a fan favorite.
I was thinking the same thing, in that they want to emphasize the important issues that DS9 delved into. And obviously the poverty issue is a really interesting element that we didn't see really tackled by the other Star Trek shows. So I can understand why that's important and why they want to showcase that. But yeah, are there fans out there that really hold Past Tense up as like DS9's finest stories? I don't think so.
But you know, it was a weird one in that when we rewatched it, we realized it was actually a really good episode.
It is,
And it's funny that maybe it doesn't have that reputation, or it doesn't stick in people's brains as much. And I wonder if it's because it's a very serious episode. It's less kind of sci-fi heavy aside from the time travel component, though. And I just wonder if kind of being less of a high concept episode did not help its legacy, even though I think it's totally deserving of this. And maybe this is what the documentary will do, is raise its profile in a way that we would like to see.
Well, maybe its legacy was that it was kind of forgotten, and they're just kind of recognizing now how ahead of its time that show was and how relevant it is today.
Yeah. And so you bring up how the show, the documentary wanted to touch some important issues, right? So at one point towards the end, you have this scene that cuts between Iris Steven Bear and the editor, where they're going through like checking boxes like homelessness, and they address past tense, check that box, blah, 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 blah. And then they got to sexual identity.
Yeah.
And look, you have an episode like Rejoined that does address it, but then Iris Steven Bear comes out and says pretty much to his editor, I don't know if we quite really nailed that one.
Right.
And so they put a question mark inside that box. It tells me that this is not this kind of, as much as it seems it could be a self-congratulatory sort of documentary, they're being realistic about maybe some of the limitations that they were facing, or even just kind of, I think Iris Steven Bear has said, I have no excuse. Like, he said that at a convention, I have no excuse. And I think what he's getting at is just kind of ignorance, or not realizing how they should have been trying to do more of these sort of stories at the time. And then you spring forward 25 years later and you realize what an important issue is, and you kind of feel like, oh, damn, I totally, you know, like biffed that one.
Right. Yeah. Because, you know, he's asked by his editor, do you think the studio would have turned it down? He said, maybe. I don't know. We never asked.
Yeah.
And yeah. And I do think it's very appropriate they leave that one with a question mark, because there isn't really an answer to that. You know, in that time, you know, the 1990s, I think a lot of people in the creative fields in TV or film would just assume we're not going to probably ask the studio this because the studio is just going to say no.
Well, remember how controversial it was when Ellen had the coming out episode?
Yeah.
And I mean, it got blockbuster ratings. It was seen as kind of this big progressive movement. But then, you know, Ellen DeGeneres has pointed out that ABC afterwards just wasn't marketing the show anymore.
Right.
And they just kind of let it kind of fizzle out.
Right.
I don't know if, you know, studios were really going all out there with these sorts of storytelling, especially when we think about how Terry Farrell brought up how there's a lot of pushback against an episode like Rejoined. I'm not saying that they shouldn't have done it. I just kind of, I can put my mind into what their mindset was at time. And, you know, but you know what? Star Trek, if you look at the 60s era, you know, I think it was about pushing those boundaries. And I think maybe Ira Steven Behr feels bad that they didn't try to push that harder.
I just wonder if a bit of it is too, is like frustration because he thinks of where we are right now and the types of, you know, you look at Discovery, which has an active gay relationship on the show. And I wonder if he just knows this and he goes like, damn, we could have done that.
Yeah.
Whereas maybe he couldn't have, but it's still that sense of like,
at least he could have told himself that he tried.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
We keep bringing up the name Ira Steven Behr, and maybe we should have said off the top that he is the showrunner for Deep Space Nine, and
or was
he was yeah.
In Tyler's mind, he's still doing DS9.
I'm still DS9 season 20 right now, my own imagination, but he's also kind of our guide and shepherd throughout this entire documentary.
Yeah, and how did you think he did?
Well, okay, that's just it. I was thinking like I was applauding the man for doing what he was doing, because who else would have been able to attack this particular subject in any other way other than the showrunner, the guiding voice for seven seasons?
Even and he's a very distinct looking guy, so he looks great on a poster.
Yeah.
And you know, even if you were to show this to some general audience member who's never watched the show, I mean, I don't know how they would fare watching this, but you would remember him.
Yeah,
you know?
But the thing that jumped out to me is like, wow, I'm surprised Ira Steven Behr is willing to put himself out there. And we got an answer by the end of it, though, because the credits ran, they turned up all the lights in the movie theater, and then there was an extended roundtable with the producers. And Ira Steven Behr explained that the co-director came up to him at a convention and said, look, I've been doing these documentaries with William Shatner. I want you to be my William Shatner for a Deep Space Nine documentary. That was David Zippon, I believe.
Yeah.
And I was like, okay, so this all fits together. It, like, this is how they convinced Ira Steven Behr to do this. He even admitted, that's the last time I ever just say okay to anybody.
Right.
You know, because I don't think he knew that he was in for, what, seven more years of making a Deep Space Nine documentary?
Yeah, it's insane.
The other insane thing that they delved into during this Q&A after the credits, though, and by the way, Cam, did you notice how hot the movie theater got
as they turned
on the lights, and they obviously turned off the environmentals in there?
Yeah.
But they delved into just how complex it was getting the HD transfer.
Right.
What originally happened is they were only going to do 5 minutes of HD, and Ira Steven Behr looked at those 5 minutes and like, we're going to do every single Deep Space Nine clip in HD.
Right.
And
there's a couple that aren't in HD, but yeah.
Well, I think they had lost a few reels here or there. They had to do a little bit of upscaling. To me, it didn't really ruin the experience, but no.
It was more noticeable, though, seeing it on the big screen. Like, I don't know if they jumped out to me at home watching my computer.
You're right.
Because there was a scene where it's Sisko singing with Vic Fontaine. I was suddenly like, what happened to that shot?
Yeah.
And I was like, did they somehow miss that one or forget about it?
Well, and there's another one where it was like Kira out in the desert, and then from one angle it's in HD, and from another angle it's in standard def.
Yeah.
So, but like those add up to about 4 seconds.
Yeah, pretty much.
But Ira Steven Behr is like, you know what? This might be the only chance that Deep Space Nine gets to be in HD.
So depressing.
Let's at least showcase it the best we can. Make sure that as much of this movie is in HD as possible. Just the thought process of having to order reels from New York, have them shipped over to California, and then you have to like tell CBS exactly what you're looking for by going through numbers in the scripts.
Yeah.
And the thing is, like, some shots were filmed on different days and they would have appeared in order on the television show. It seems like one of the most complex things that they ever had to deal with during the making of it. It tells you how passionate these people are with regards to making this. And I want them to know, though, that passion is being felt by the fans. And I think it's being expressed by the fans right now as we're seeing like fan reaction over social media.
Do you think there's any chance CBS looks at the response to this documentary and goes,
I don't think there's a zero chance.
Yeah.
I say there is some chance. You know, I just wonder if the economics make sense based on maybe how many units they sold of
the TNG ones.
The TNG ones. But the thing I wonder, though, is units sold really like a proper measurement of how successful that investment was based on, say, look at how many people are watching TNG through streaming and how much that licensing agreement is worth for CBS, knowing that there's like high quality version of TNG out there.
Right. Like and it's easy to say because it's not my money. I almost wish though that CBS would look at DS9 and Voyager almost more as like legacy shows that are going to be continued to be rewatched and rewatched. And it's worth it to them to keep it going because there's obviously an audience that's going to be there for it.
Like, it's tough to make that argument for, say, Hogan's Heroes.
Sure. But, hey, how dare you?
But you know what? Look,
Colonel Klink, man.
The original series is still being watched more than 50 years later.
Yeah.
I think you can guarantee that Deep Space Nine is going to still be watched 50 years from now.
Exactly.
Maybe they make the investment. Maybe technology progresses that it's going to be exponentially cheaper to do in like 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe that's what they're waiting on, but I
could they ever get just the funding for it through a streaming network, the way that Discovery was paid for by, you know, through streaming?
I don't think the economics quite work.
No?
Yeah. One thing with regards to HD, though, seeing it on the big screen, seeing, like, the space battles on the big screen, it was just mind-blowing. It was unbelievable. I've never seen Deep Space Nine look this good.
Mm-hmm.
There was even details in the Defiant that I was not able to pick up when I was watching it on my MacBook a couple weeks ago. I was just blown away by how gorgeous this show is able to look with this HD. And the color correction that the season 3 through 7 director of photography was able to imbue upon it. Jonathan West. You can tell there's so much love put into this one here.
And also how majestic the sets are, in that a lot of the time they get a bit of a washed out look on your standard definition, especially watching on an HD TV. And a lot of the time, too, I find the Netflix streaming versions are terrible.
Yeah.
And so you kind of look at those.
I prefer watching Deep Space Nine on my DVD sets.
Same. Yeah. Same. But I appreciated that seeing it in this HD on the big screen, you kind of get an understand or a much better understanding of how majestic the sets were and why they were so impressive. Because it's the sort of thing that if you're a modern TV viewer now and you turn on those standard definition DVDs, you're like, yeah, I guess it's fine.
Yeah.
It just doesn't look visually impressive, whereas it really did in the HD format.
One of the other things we should address, though, is Avery Brooks's involvement with this.
Lack thereof, yeah.
Lack thereof. And that said, they devote more time, I think, to Avery Brooks than anybody else in this documentary. I think there's some other people that a lot of other actors that do get a lot of screen time, but they make sure that Avery Brooks is well represented in this. And
yeah,
they go back to archival footage, either from conventions or previous interviews. You get his thoughts. And I think a lot of people would say maybe Avery Brooks doesn't have that much more to add anymore to what the legacy is. He's spoken on it quite a bit throughout the years.
Mm-hmm.
So I can appreciate that. So I wouldn't go into it thinking, oh no, I can't watch this because there's no active Avery Brooks involvement.
Right.
I think it still does well by Avery Brooks, especially when you talk about, you know, say Far Beyond the Stars or people recounting stories of Avery Brooks, the director.
Yeah.
And what an experience that must have been, where he's just whispering into Casey Biggs' ear, glide. or to Jeffrey Combs, slalom.
Yeah.
And people kept saying, you know, Avery Brooks is not somebody who speaks in full sentences. He had like this great montage of people just saying jazz musician, jazz musician, jazz musician. And that's how they describe him.
And then it cuts to Avery Brooks recounting an experience with a fan where she asked him like his favorite mission or something.
Or favorite character.
Or favorite character, I should say. Yeah, favorite character. And his response is just like, huh. As someone who's seen Avery Brooks many a times at conventions, or at least, you know, 3 or 4, I was like, yep.
He is a character.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, but look, he had a big impact. And one thing, like a moment that Terry Farrell was recounting, is how she said, look, you can't call me old man in this very stern way. I'm this 28-year-old woman. Like, you need to pull back. Help me out here. And I think he was like, okay, I'll take what you're saying. And then they actually showed a clip where you could tell he is pulling back and just being warmer in his performance there. And one of the things that they point out that Stephen Bear points out to Mark Alamo is like, you and Avery Brooks are very similar in the way you perform in a scene. You are taking up as much as you can, and it's up to the other actor to match you, and they have to go for it. And I think that's genius in that it brings out a lot of great stuff from other actors that they're performing with in this.
Mark Alamo comes off very interesting in this documentary.
You need to go watch Mark Alamo in this documentary, and he has a reputation as being a real character. And this totally just emphasizes that. But
there was a part where the audience was like, ooh, about something he said.
Sure.
It was in relation to, I believe, the Kira character and her relationship with Dukat.
Yeah. But there's another great moment with when Nana visited her, where she was talking about the one time she ever felt she was in a fight with Iris Demon Baron, because he wanted Kira to have a relationship with Gul Dukat, and she said, anybody but Mark Alamo. And then the audience started just cracking up, and she's like, oh no, I meant Gul Dukat.
The genius of the documentary too is they set that story after Mark Alamo's had some testimonials, so that the audience has a firm idea as to who this character is, who this actor is.
Yeah.
And that just makes it like just over the top funny.
But I mean, I don't know, there's just so much just to like take in, even from like kind of the fights with the executives that Iris Stephen Bear is willing to have. And they even had like executives in there to kind of explain where they're coming from, and that this is an era where serialization just wasn't a thing.
Yeah.
Iris Stephen Bear was kind of ahead of his time though.
Definitely,
like,
yeah.
He was realizing like this Deep Space Nine doesn't work without serialization. And the way that he was willing to butt heads, he's willing to push things forward. I think we have to really appreciate it. I don't know how much we could have appreciated at the time as it was going on, though.
Oh, for sure. I think one of the best things that ever happened to DS9 was that it wasn't popular. Because if a studio has a show they're going to keep going that's just not that popular, they don't really care that much. So suddenly you can do all these sorts of weird things. You know, it's kind of like when Fox first started, the early days of Fox, and they had the X-Files. Fox was such a new network, they didn't really know what to do. So a lot of the creators had free rein to do whatever they wanted. And so you got these shows like X-Files and The Simpsons and even Married with Children, a show that has not aged well, at the time was seen as very outside the norm for what a sitcom was. And so like DS9 kind of had that factor too, where they're too focused on TNG movies and Voyager. The DS9 just kind of does its own thing and ends up being revolutionary because of that.
Well, it was being referred to disparagingly as the middle child.
Yeah.
It was probably the best thing that could have ever happened to them.
I want to talk about Rick Berman for a second.
Okay.
Because Rick Berman pops up in this documentary a few times. And Rick Berman is a personality I find very interesting to see in these documentaries on Star Trek, in that I have no gauge on what Rick Berman thinks of Deep Space Nine.
Especially after coming out of this.
I think,
okay, the one hint that we do get is that Rick Berman said, in reference to one thing that Iris Stephen Bear convinced him to do, he said, well, you conned me into that, like you usually do.
Right.
I would thought he was going to say something, and you were right.
Yeah.
But he never did say that.
No.
Yeah, so it was kind of...
And his compliments were kind of like, yep, we had some good characters there. ... And it's like, okay, well, is that it?
But you could definitely tell that at the time, Voyager was more of his baby.
Mm-hmm.
Doing the movies was his thing, too.
Even Enterprise.
Enterprise, yeah. I just don't think... I don't know if he felt the sense of ownership over Deep Space Nine because of how strong of a, you know, character Iris Stephen Bear was, and how strong of a creative force Iris Stephen Bear was as well. So yeah.
I just wonder if Rick Berman, too, when he's walking into the writer's room of TNG, he's like, yeah, this is definitely my kind of vibe. And when he walks into the DS9 one, it's just like, I don't know what these guys are doing.
Yeah.
Like, DS9 is definitely, like, the geekiest of the Star Trek shows. Like, it feels like a room full of just, like, inmates running the asylum.
Again, I'm cracking up the line where Worf, we see an HD shot of Worf saying, I was considered quite amusing aboard the Enterprise. And then Jadzia responds, that must have been one dull ship.
Yeah. I'm so glad they had that clip in it. Like, they could have thrown in a bunch of Worf comedy moments just to amuse me, and I would have been really happy.
Okay, Cam, how shocked were you during the credits where Nana Visitor says, now we have to play the greatest clip in Deep Space Nine history, and they go to the clip from Move Along Home, where they're going like, Alan Moraine, and it's just like, and then the entire auditorium is just howling at like the absurdity of it all.
That is a moment I think you have to recognize within DS9 because the first season was bumpy. I think the only other way to do it was they could have worked it probably into the overall body if they're talking about maybe how it took them a while to find the show and you have a cutaway to that or something, but they had to do it. Yeah. It's too funny to not. Did you have any moments though that kind of like you thought just didn't quite work well or were like little nitpicks where you thought, that didn't fit into the overall documentary as well as it should have.
I kind of touched upon them, and they weren't huge issues for me. I like past tense, but there were other episodes I probably would have put in their place. But I think what they were ultimately getting at was, checking the boxes. Mm-hmm. And that sequence in which Ira Stephen Bear says, you know what, maybe we didn't earn our sexual identity box. I'll say this. I think they needed to acknowledge that they didn't feel as if they earned it, but that sequence kind of took me out of the momentum of the documentary.
I actually wrote a note about that. I didn't take many notes for this because it was still very fresh in my memory. But
then why did you keep shining your iPhone light all over the movie theater? I thought you were using a notepad at the time.
I was reaching for Kleenex for you.
Okay.
I don't think it does shtick very well. And this sequence, to me, I understand exactly what they're trying to do, but let's face it, like Ira Stephen Bear, and he's sitting with the one of the editors on the film. They're not actors, and it gets a little stiff because they're kind of playing it like it's supposed to be like this natural discussion back and forth, but it feels like two guys who've memorized their lines.
Sure.
And I'm like, oh, this is kind of awkward.
Yeah.
I don't know another way to do it because they obviously kind of want to do a little bit of a speed round to touch on the issues the show delved into. But it's a little bit clunky. I mean, it's brief. It's in the scheme of things, it's a blip, but it did stand out to me. The only other moment to me that was a little, just in terms of its placement or a little bit of awkwardness, was there's a point where Stephen Bear just kind of turns and he's facing the camera and he says, I just want to acknowledge the writers we didn't have in this writers panel for the season 8. And it does feel like this moment that's an island. Where it's like, we didn't quite know where to put it, so we put it here.
I think he knew he needed to acknowledge these colleagues that sacrificed a lot, and he leaned on quite a bit. And
yeah.
So, but maybe that's a perfect segue into what we need to discuss here, though, is this hypothetical season 8. We get to go into this. This is why this documentary is just so out of this world, kind of like wackadoodle, sort of. I've never seen anything like this. In which they literally have a session in the writer's room where over the course of one day, they break a hypothetical season 8 premiere, though. Mm-hmm. And the story that's being told, I mean, I didn't know if it would feel like Deep Space Nine. I didn't know how interesting the story is going to be. And I was quite happy with how this seems to be a bit of a throat-clearing session to a certain degree, but also setting up some very intriguing stuff and having a lot of moments that feel like the Deep Space Nine characters. So, and that's what we ultimately care about most with this show, though, is kind of the characters here. And then that's kind of the intriguing thing that I think they want to further develop.
Right. Yeah, no, I agree 100%. Like, when they pitched this idea, I was really uncertain as to how it would actually play, especially when Ira Stephen Bear had said since, like, oh, yeah, we forgot Quark, you know, and I was like, oh, no. Like, what am I getting? You know, is this just going to be kind of clunky and not feel like an episode that would exist within the show? You know what I mean? Kind of like, hey, guys, what's everyone up to? Oh, I don't know. Kier's doing this or that. And you'd just be like, it would feel more like a checklist of what characters are up to. But I like that the way they present it in the documentary, it really does feel like a story.
Well, let's talk about what the story was. Essentially, we find Nog racing from a ship, an unknown enemy. Then we flash back 2 weeks earlier aboard Deep Space Nine, and we kind of find out where the crew is right now. Kira is a Vedic. Mm-hmm. The station itself is actually more of a shrine to the prophets at this point.
How did you feel about that?
I thought that was interesting. It showed that the world is changing, and it showed that, you know what, the Starfleet wasn't successful with its original mission, which was to get Bajor into the Federation. Mm-hmm. And there was a very small Starfleet contingent left aboard, and we get to catch up with a lot of these characters because essentially Quark is going around delivering messages saying like, hey, can you come to the holosuite, essentially? And they're like, huh, what? Everybody agrees, whether, you know, Ezri and Bashir are aboard the USS Emmett Till.
Yeah.
She's in command. He's the chief medical officer. We have O'Brien back at Starfleet Academy. Worf is on Kronos. They all come back just for this one message. We find out that Vic Fontaine is dying.
Right.
Well, so they claimed.
Yeah.
It's really just Nog's effort to, I guess, pass on another message, and we don't know what it is. We eventually find out that a bunch of Jem'Hadar soldiers have converted to worshiping the prophets, which was...
And they're the new Bajoran army?
And yeah, now they're representing the new Bajoran army. So I was like, okay.
I wouldn't have predicted that one.
No. So I'm intrigued by what these soldiers, you know, worship means to them.
Okay, yeah.
I'm very interested in what the implications are of these Jem'Hadar converting.
Do you view this as a story that is particularly positive for the Bajoran contingent here? I don't either. When I see this, I was like,
well,
this sure reminds me of some real world parallels that are a little uncomfortable.
Kira seems complicit in
yes.
a lot of this, but who's to say the Bajorans aren't allowed to pull this stuff?
Sure.
But then we also find out that Section 31 is somehow involved.
Yeah.
I'm not quite, I wasn't quite following. Was Section 31 responsible for destroying Nog's ship?
Yes.
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 So they didn't want Nog passing on the information that the Jem'Hadar, and it was actually Garak that informed Worf of this.
Right.
And so I was like, okay, I was trying to follow the plot threads that I'm sure will take 25 more episodes in season 8 for us to figure out here. But whatever, the plot didn't matter that much to me. It was the character stuff that did. And I'm wondering how the characters felt to you as you're watching this.
I mean, the characters felt like you didn't really miss a beat. Like, yeah. It felt like the characters. I guess my issues were more with just like the story. Like, because the characters, I expect the original writers to be able to pull those off again. It was more just like, this is the direction that in a hypothetical world I could have gotten was strange. It felt very strange. And I don't even mean that in a good or a bad way. Just in a, I'm going to have to wrap my head around this one because it feels strange.
I'm in episode one mode. It's like they're planting seeds. And
sure.
You've got 25 more episodes after this. I feel as if things will expand and become sure. clearer. I have a tough time believing that Kira is somehow complicit with something nefarious that's going on.
Of course, you know? Yeah, yeah.
But
the idea of like Section 31 declaring war on the Bajoran faith is interesting. I don't know. Like, I didn't. Maybe we're so Section 31'd out at this point,
yeah.
just from Discovery and from Into Darkness, that I'm like, oh, more Section 31. Okay. And the fact that Bashir was going to be tied into this in some way.
He's going to be running Section 31.
Yeah. Yeah.
I thought that was actually kind of interesting in that.
Yeah.
You know, one of the writers said in the writer's room, well, you know, some characters go down wayward paths and, you know, this is just Bashir. And I'm like, okay. Well,
how would Ezri not be aware of this?
Look, they're. Black Ops can. They, you know, they can pull off anything.
Right.
But I wonder if Bashir is the one running it because he feels he could fix this
like the
institution.
Sins of, yeah, yeah. 31.
But, and so I have to believe, look, episode one, whatever we're finding out here, it's not everything is as, you know, meets the eye. So
right.
I'm not going to get too hung up on some of the stuff that makes you kind of scratch your head. But the other two characters that we must mention, though, is like they briefly said, hey, maybe it should be Odo investigating this. Like mm-hmm. Kira asks Odo to return to investigate the death of Nog. And then Ira Stephen Bear says, you know what? We can hold on to surprises further down the road in this hypothetical season. So I thought that was like a very interesting thing. It seemed as if like it's a real writer's room.
Right.
Lastly, Cam, we have Sisko appears.
That is such a great moment.
It really worked for me, though.
It actually reminded me a lot of the ending of the film version of Watchmen. I think it was actually not even the ending of that movie, but the ending that they originally pitched, where Dr. Manhattan was going to show up on screens all over the world and warn them. And that's pretty much what they do in this, where Sisko is showing up all over the galaxy, basically, warning people that he's coming back or what have you. And then we cut to him appearing to Jake. And I was like, that's perfect. Like, that is just a brilliant way to bring that character back.
They even address, you know, like, Molly O'Brien is all grown up. Nog is captain of a ship. We have one Joseph Yates Sisko is a science officer.
I wish they delved into that character a little bit more.
Yeah.
Just give us a couple sentences as to who this character is.
Yeah.
Because he's introduced as meeting Jake, but we don't really get anything out of that.
But one of my favorite moments in this, and it's actually coming from Molly O'Brien, where everybody's sitting around in Quark's bar saying like, oh yeah, Nog, can't believe he's gone. And Molly O'Brien's like, you guys all know him as the kid.
Yeah.
He was my commanding officer. I know him as this leader, as this adult. Like, whatever Nog was up to, it actually meant something. You guys need to give him the benefit of the doubts. And to me, it was just funny that Molly O'Brien is responsible for like one of my favorite moments in this entire documentary.
Wasn't that always the case though with DS9?
Oh, especially when she's like hanging off like wires in Time's Orphan.
Of course.
Yeah. So.
No, I like that too. Like one of the strengths of DS9, and they touch on it in the documentary, is just how stacked its supporting cast of recurring characters was. They named them all out. Philip Anglim gets a shout out. And I was so
Camille
happy.
Camille Saviola gets Camille a shout Saviola, out. Camille Saviola.
Yeah. And even the guy that played, what's
Shikar.
His name? Shikar. Yeah. Yeah. That's amazing. Again, once again, I'm sitting in a theater watching a big screen movie and someone is referencing Philip Anglim.
They know that we wanted Vedic Ryle in there. Speaking of stuff that maybe they knew we wanted, we touch on this in our non-spoiler review, but our good friend James Chesser appears briefly doing a fan testimonial, and our good friend Shelley Ross, she appears briefly. You and I, along with two of our other good friends, Stefan Estanilo and Scott Hardy.
Plus James again.
James gets a second appearance. We appear briefly just in images of us that appear on screen from these fan testimonials that we got to film a couple years back in the Star Trek Las Vegas convention.
Yeah, near the end, there's the is it the cinematographer or the art director? One of them is talking about what DS9 meant to him, and then he references the fans, and it cuts to basically a montage of images, and we are in there.
Yeah. So
that was very cool. Once again, surreal to see on the big screen.
Just like people you know, like, and are friends with, just talking about their love of Star Trek on the big screen. Cam, just any final thoughts? Like, what is this going to be kind of the enduring Star Trek documentary from here on forward?
What's its competition?
I'd say Trekkies, just because of how well known it is.
Yeah.
I'd say you and I, we actually did think that Chaos on the Bridge was an entertaining sort of thing. I just don't know if it's penetrated into kind of the fan culture the way that we would have expected to. But I don't know. Like, what do you think its competition could be other than this?
In terms of what I look for in a Star Trek documentary, I think the closest in terms of my enjoyment probably would be Chaos on the Bridge. Like, I really enjoy Trekkies, but Trekkies is also something that's a little more mainstream, a little more kind of like, isn't this an interesting subculture kind of thing?
It doesn't seem like a love letter to the fans so much.
A little bit, and it doesn't talk down to them, I think, in the way maybe a different documentary
but
would.
You brought it up, like, hey, isn't this like a funny little fan culture?
Yeah,
and
yeah.
You've got like the woman who goes to jury duty in her uniform.
Right.
I feel as if this documentary, the Deep Space Nine one, was more indicative of kind of the mainstream hardcore fans, though, like the everyday like fans that you see versus the ones that take it to the extreme and go grocery shopping in Star Trek underwear, and nothing but.
Well, that's me. But I mean,
and you podcast that way too.
Exactly. Yeah. What I really love in a Star Trek documentary is one that feels like warts and all, and is telling me something that I have no way of knowing. Not necessarily in terms of like, you know, the details of a production of an episode or anything like that, but just where people are saying things like, I never would have been able to hear that anywhere else. And like Chaos on the Bridge gives you that, where there's some real negativity and just some of the infighting going on during the first couple seasons of TNG and the way the participants, you know, tell those stories. And that's something that this documentary actually touches on, is the sense of like, it's tough to know how much is actually accurate because of human memory, but it's all true because it's all their reflections and their feelings about it. And I feel like that's what Chaos on the Bridge does really well. And I think this documentary trumps it. This documentary is working with just a much bigger budget and resources than what Chaos on the Bridge was working with. I mean, I don't even know how long Chaos on the Bridge even really took to put together. But like this one is just like that taken to as far as it could probably ever go. I just don't think we're going to see anything like this ever again.
Do you think that we would ever get a definitive Voyager or Enterprise documentary, or do you think it's really kind of, you have to look to the DVD or Blu-ray special features and that's really going to be what where the story is? Or do you think we will get a chance to see, I guess, the best equivalent of a What We Left Behind documentary from those respective series?
I don't know. I don't know that they, the thing with DS9 is you have Iris Stephen Bear, who's very much like the ultimate cheerleader for his show, really, in that like he was the one helping get all this together. He oversaw this project. He co-directed it. He was passionate about telling the fans all they could about DS9. And I mentioned this in a Instagram post I made about this movie, the experience that we saw, and that, like, I've rarely seen a creator of something seem to so understand what fans love about his creation. Mm. Like, so often, you know, you'll have someone who makes a hit movie or something, and they're talking about, yeah, we think the fans would like this. And it's like, did you understand what people liked in the first one? Or, like, they learned bad lessons. That happens all the time across the board. But it seems like Ira Stephen Bear understands the fan culture surrounding the show better than just about any creator I can even think of.
How much does the fact that he's had 25 years to reflect on it help?
I would say maybe. But there's also the fact, you know, you look at Gene Roddenberry, right? Like, he writes that original series. It's genius. But then you look at what he's doing with some of the early TNG and even the motion picture. Like, did he understand what fans sure. liked in Star Trek?
Yeah.
And he had 25 years.
Yeah.
I just think it tends to be the personality. Does George Lucas understand what people like in Star Wars anymore? I don't think so. And Ridley Scott definitely doesn't know what people want in Alien movie. So it just seems like Ira Stephen Bear just has the right personality or the right perspective, and maybe always did. He just seems like a very... He seems like a down-to-earth guy in a lot of ways. Someone who yeah. would actually talk to fans and actually listens to what fans are saying.
Well, I mean, for listeners who may not know, like, I got to have an extended conversation with him at a convention, like, more than once. Like, mm-hmm. I remember he was doing a panel, mm-hmm. and he was supposed to be up on the stage.
Yeah.
And he kind of looked around. He's like, do you guys want to go get a coffee? Yeah. And he walked to the back of the room where they're serving coffee, and he bought every single person who wanted a cup of coffee or a cup of tea that beverage.
Right.
And he just said, so I don't know, let's just stand in a circle and just throw some questions at me. And so we're all huddled. I got to talk to him about past tense of all episodes.
Yeah.
Maybe I was the one who influenced its inclusion in the documentary. But, you know, and then a couple nights later, Scott Hardy, our good friend of the show, he and I, we went up and we were wearing our Deep Space Nine sweatshirts, and we got photos taken with him. And then mm-hmm. I spoke to Ira Stephen Bear at length about, like, working with Iggy Pop.
Yeah.
It was just like he, like you said, he's down to earth. I think he wants to be connected to the fans. But I also wonder, okay, did the fans know at the time what they needed or wanted from the characters? Did they appreciate it at the time, or did that grow over the years? You know, I would say it took me a couple years for Deep Space Nine to become my favorite series.
Though. Right.
But once I think I was hooked by season 5, that's when I knew definitively it was my favorite Star Trek series.
Well, they say never write for the fans.
Yeah.
That never works out well.
I agree 100%.
Yeah. And I think he stuck to that because, you know, throughout the documentary, he's reading some of the hate mail they got on the air and having the cast members read that stuff too. And yeah.
What did he say about it when I think it was either Rene Bergeron or Armin Shimerman said, like, can you actually read that?
Oh, it was
like,
Aaron Eisenberg.
Yeah. 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 What did, do you recall what Ira Stephen Bear said?
He said, like, he thought it was great. It means we touched a nerve. It means we were doing something that was working.
Yeah.
And it just, you know, some people were really pissed off.
You don't want to write kind of the vanilla stuff that doesn't get a reaction from one people one way or another. And
right.
I think, you know, that's what they did best on Deep Space Nine. They were telling stories that mattered. They're telling stories that still resonate, and they're doing that through the lens of these amazing characters. And I think that's what they captured in a way I could have never hoped for, you know, going into this documentary. And I was so blown away by this.
Well, Jeffrey Combs mentions, you know, that this was the first Star Trek show that had the journey that was internal. Like, it was all about the characters and their evolution. And those types of stories are timeless. And I think that's why DS9's legacy continues so strongly, and why it's more likely, I think, to convert new fans over to it than maybe some of the others, like Enterprise or Voyager, just because the character journeys are so riveting. And you look at all these shows that are hugely popular, whether it's shows like Walking Dead or Game of Thrones or what have you, they're tracking characters. And that's what fans latch onto, and, you know, viewers latch onto. The esoteric kind of sci-fi trappings of a high-concept Voyager episode or Enterprise episode isn't necessarily what's going to grab everyone. It's not going to grab the mainstream audiences, but when it's characters that really speak to them, that's what really gets those passionate responses. You know, not everyone who was obsessed with Breaking Bad was fascinated by the drug industry. You know what I mean? It's like the journey of Walter White and Jesse that won them over. And DS9, you know, really ahead of its time in doing that. And so, like, I just thought it was just really interesting to see the documentary really underscore that.
So we agree, the definitive Star Trek documentary, at least for now?
Yeah, I mean, I was just looping back to your question earlier, like, could this ever happen for a Voyager or Enterprise? I mean, you know, I said Irish Stephen Bear was very much the shepherd of this. I just don't see Brennan Braga being passionate enough to get out there and be Kickstartering and then spending 7 years on a Voyager documentary. I just don't think that ever happens.
Yeah.
I think you need an Irish Stephen Bear who has that glint of kind of a wonderful madness that keeps him going on this path.
Well, like you said, he's probably this very unique individual who's going to be willing to do that.
Mm-hmm.
I can't appreciate it enough. I think what he set out to do, and he made it very clear when he was talking about the HD stuff, he's like, you know what? If this is your one shot to do it, you better do it the best damn that you can. And I think that he totally did that with this documentary.
Definitely.
Here,
so. Yeah. Is there another show you think would support one where you could get this type of really juicy material?
The closest I think we could ever hope for is maybe Discovery, like 20 years down the road, because we know there's a lot of background stuff going on, behind the scenes stuff going on. So I do wonder, but I just don't, who's going to be that shepherd? It would have to be Alex Kurtzman, but I don't picture him giving a warts and all presentation of how this series came to be.
Kurtzman's also a student of the modern age where you don't let a lot of background details out. It's all about a narrative you're spinning.
Yeah.
And so I don't know how truthful they'll be going forward in terms of these stories as to the productions, because we live in a Disney-ruled world now, and Disney does not like that stuff. And they kind of set the tone for everyone else in a lot of ways. And I just don't know that Kurtzman will be 20 years from now being like, yeah, let's tell about that disastrous first season where everything was falling apart, but we were holding it together just through a charismatic cast.
Yeah.
I don't know. But okay, I think on that note, our assignment is complete. If you enjoyed listening to this podcast, we want to hear from you. Jump on over to our Facebook page at facebook.com/subspacepod. Let us know what you thought of the What We Left Behind documentary. What are your thoughts? What were its strengths? What were your favorite moments? Let us know. Now, Tyler, what are we doing next week?
Ken, we are going to do a 10-year retrospective on the J.J. Abrams universe, the Kelvinverse. Of course, it's been 10 years since Star Trek 2009 premiered. Yes, I can do mathematics. So we're going to think about the trilogy as a whole, what its legacy is so far.
Trilogy, you mean quadrilogy,
and,
right, Tyler?
And maybe what the future holds, too.
Yeah. Oh, that's going to be really cool. And I'm actually looking forward to revisiting those movies. Okay, so you can, of course, find us on the Twitter. I'm at Cam, V as in Vedic on the big screen, Smith.
You can find me at Reportin, that's R-E-P, P as in Palak on the big screen, O-R-T-O-N.
What a wet noodle of a character.
It has to be the most generic Bajoran character that they ever have had, and they've gotten a lot of those.
Good on them for keeping that tradition going, I guess. Okay, so until next time, the arena is closed.
Transfer complete.